of the series that we've been working through called God's at War. If you're new to faith today or maybe been away for a little bit, in this series, we are discussing one of the most talked about issues in the Bible, the issue of idolatry, which we've been saying, like, on the surface of our lives, it seems like this isn't a big deal. That idols are just these statues from far off places, times long, long ago, and how is this relevant to you or me? But in this series, we're discovering that what qualifies as an idol, what qualifies as a false god, can be far more abstract and is far more present in our lives than we might have thought. In fact, we've been saying that in this series, we've been defining an idol or a false god this way. We've been saying that an idol or a false god is anything that competes with the one true God for first place in our lives. Anything that we trust in, or anyone who we trust in more than God, or rely on more than God, or are willing to make sacrifices for more than God, or long for more than God, or direct our lives by more than God, can be an idol. And so in the series, what we've discovered is that there's a war going on for your heart and for mine. A war that's raging between the false gods of our age and the one true God for who's going to sit on the throne of our hearts. And it's important who wins that war. Because whichever God or God sits on the throne of your heart or mine determines the direction and the outcome of our lives for good or for bad. So each week we're looking at a different false god, one that's relevant and just present in our day and age. And we're just going, hey, how does this thing work? And what can we do to dethrone it if it's managed to worm its way onto the throne of our hearts? So we'll take a minute, we'll pray, and then we'll move on. We'll look at the false god that we're going to talk about today. Would you pray with me, please? Father, thanks again just for time to come together, just to worship you, just to be with one another, just to try and hear your truth. Father, we just thank you, just as Pastor Laura was talking about, for KICY Radio, the work that they are doing, how they are trying to bring your truth to places that are remote and in a lot of ways don't have access to you or to the gospel. Father, we pray you bless that work, that you would provide, that people's lives would be changed and drawn to Jesus because of it. Father, we want to pray that there's just so many needs among us. We want to pray those specifically, just for Johannes' dad and his health. God, thank you that he is off of the ventilator. And while things look so desperate, there's some hope in the midst of this. God, we pray for your hand of healing on him and on his body, for his wife and for his kids. And Father, just as we take time to consider your truth today, open our hearts and our minds to you and to what you have to say to us. In Jesus' name, amen. So as we continue today we're going to talk about the false god of money. Who's excited? All right, three, all right. I get it, all right. Here's the deal, though. If we're really going to talk about the false gods that are most common in our day and age, you can't not talk about this. To try and skimp on this, it'd just be ministerial negligence on our part not to talk about this one. Because of all the gods that would try and sit on the throne of your heart and mine, money is one of those. And God knows this. I think it's one of the reasons that the Bible talks so much about this topic. In fact, it's one of the reasons why Jesus talked so much about money. Did you know that about 25% of Jesus' recorded teaching was about money or wealth or possessions? One in four of the things that Jesus talked about had to do with this topic. And I think Jesus talked so much about this because he understood how easy it is for money to get between us and God, how easy it is for that to compete with God for first place in your life and mine. And so today what we want to do is we just want to look at one of those teachings on Jesus' part when it comes to this topic. Now, this particular teaching comes as Jesus is talking about a number of things. In fact, in Luke 12, we find Jesus with this massive crowd of people who have come to hear him teach. And they're kind of stacked, one on top of another. And as Jesus is teaching, this is one of these things where he's not messing around. Like, he's coming in hard. He's talking about topics like sin. He's talking about, like, the final judgment where our entire lives are going to be displayed before God and everyone else to see. He talks about things like, hey, don't worry about people who can take your life. No, worry about God who has the power of heaven and hell over your soul. He talks about being faithful in this life. He talks about God's provision and protection in the midst of persecution. I mean, just heavy topics. And in the midst of all this weight, some guy who's in the crowd gets a word in edgewise. Now, I don't know how this worked. Like, if you want to ask Jesus a question or if you want to make a comment while he's teaching, I don't know if there's a line that you have to get in or if there's, like, take a number system or if the disciples randomly just go out the crowd and pick people. I don't know. However it works, this guy gets to say something. Anybody want to guess what this guy wants to talk about? Yeah, it's not too hard. That's what we're talking about today. Thank you, Stuart, right? All right. I mean, Jesus is dropping, like, theological bombs on these people. And this guy, when he gets a word in edgewise with Jesus, he wants to talk about money. He says, teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me. All right? Now, we've been talking about this in the previous couple weeks. Chances are this guy is the younger brother. Because in Semitic culture, right, when daddy dies, the eldest brother gets twice as much as the younger brother. And this kid, he's like, I'm not okay with that. And so while Jesus is talking about some of the most important things in life, this guy's trying to figure out a way to get Jesus to make his older brother cough up some of the cash. And so Jesus says to him, he says, man, who appointed me judge and arbitrator between you? Now, I suspect that Jesus was talking to both the younger brother and the older brother, because the you here in the original language is plural. So if Jesus was from the south, he would have said, you know, who made me arbitrator between all you all, right? He's talking to both of them. And then he says to them, watch out. Be on your guard against all kinds of greed. Life does not consist in an abundance of possessions. And then Jesus goes on to tell a story about people who might struggle with greed. People who might be losing the war with the god of money. But before we dive into Jesus' story, it's probably worthwhile just to go, hey, let's make sure we're all on the same page for what we're talking about when we say greed. How would Jesus define this thing? The word here that we have translated as greed, it comes from a couple of root words, one being more and the other to have. So not too difficult to figure out. You put those together and the idea is, I want to have more. I dream about having more. I feel like I got to have more. It's kind of the opposite of being content with what I already have. And then as Jesus tells his story, he's going to dial in the definition for us a little bit more. By the time Jesus gets done, we're going to see that for Jesus, here's what greed is. Greed is already having enough to meet my needs, but wanting more for me anyway. I've got enough. I've got enough to take care of my needs, but I want more, and I want it for me. So Jesus' story about greed, it starts like this. It says, the ground of a certain rich man yielded an abundant harvest. So Jesus starts talking about a guy who's got a lot of money. And here's the thing. That's not a bad thing. That's not a good thing. This guy being wealthy, it doesn't make him a villain. It doesn't make him a hero. Biblically speaking, the absence or the presence of money in a person's life doesn't speak to their godliness. It's what they do with it that does. And it's probably worthwhile for us to define rich before we go on as well. Because oftentimes, we have a tendency when we hear this term rich to think, oh, Jesus is talking about somebody else. In fact, we're going to play a fun game. I want you to look around the room. Do not point the person out. Right? I want you to look around the room and find somebody who probably has more money than you do. Take a look around. Find somebody who's a couple rungs on the ladder higher than you are, all right? just, you know, you saw what they drove in here, you know, you saw what they're wearing today, all right? You know where they, so just find somebody. Again, don't point them out. And I have you do that because here's the deal. Jesus will say, let's talk about this rich guy. And the natural thing for us to do is to think of the person we spotted in the room today and go, well, yeah, Jesus is talking about them. He's not talking to me. All the while remaining comfortably ignorant to the fact that if we're sitting in this room today on a global scale, we're rich. For example, if you make more than $20,000 a year today, you make more money than 96% of the people on the planet today. 20 grand puts you in the top 4%. Or if today you have access to your own vehicle, or you live in a house that's bigger than 100 square feet, that's 10 by 10 if you're not good with math, right? Or if you have appliances and furniture in that house, or you have so many clothes you need a closet to hold them all, or you got so much food that if you don't put it in a fridge, it'll go bad, right? If you have access to water and electricity on a global scale, you are filthy rich. See, if you have the privilege of living here in America, you won life's lottery. When Jesus talks about the rich, you don't have to feel guilty about it. You don't have to feel bad about it. It is what it is. But when Jesus is talking about the rich, he's talking about you. He's talking about me. If you have enough to meet your needs, you're the rich Jesus is talking about. So Jesus says, the ground of a certain rich man yielded an abundant harvest. And he thought to himself, what shall I do? I have no place to store my crops. Which isn't exactly true. Because then he says to himself, this is what I will do. I'll tear down my barns and build bigger ones, and there I will store my surplus grain. So here's this guy who already has enough to meet his needs, and more comes in. And he thinks, oh my goodness, what am I going to do? I've got no place to put my grain. Which again, it is not exactly true, because you can't tear down the barns you have to build bigger barns if you don't already have barns. So the problem isn't that he has no place to put his stuff. The problem is the place where his stuff is now that holds more than enough isn't big enough to hold the more than enough that has already come in. And so he thinks, all right, well, I'm going to tear down the barns that I've got, and I'm going to build bigger barns than the ones I already have, and that's going to hold all this stuff that's just come in for me. Now, before we bag on this guy, we really shouldn't. Because this guy, he's really just a good American. He's a little ahead of his time, but really, he's just a good American. Think about it. Can anybody tell me what the average square footage in a house in 1950 was? Anybody want to take a guess? 1,000 square feet. Bing, bing, bing. You get an extra cookie after church today. All right. So 1950, 1,000 square feet. You jump to 1970, 1,500 square feet, average size of a home. You jump to the year 2000, 2,200 square feet. Now let's go back to 1950. Anybody want to take a guess what the average family size here in America has done since 1950? It's gone down, that's right, it's been shrinking. And yet, this is so fun. Even though there are fewer of us to fit in our homes that are twice as big now, we can't fit all our stuff in there, can we? Some I won't make you raise your hand. Some of us cannot get our car in our garage. And we can't get our car in our garage because our house that is twice as big as it was 70 years ago, the stuff is now overflowed into the garage, right? Well, somebody in the back raising their hand. That was sort of gutsy. You're in the back, right? Okay. So, yeah, that's right. You come rushing to the front. It's me. It's me. While I'm getting ready for this, I saw this fascinating statistic. For every 5 storage facilities in our country, we have 1 Starbucks. Think about that. Starbucks are everywhere. They're like cockroaches. They just keep breeding, right? For every 1 Starbucks you see, there are 5 personal storage facilities in this country. Our houses are twice as big. There are fewer people in them. It's overflowed into our garages. And now we, bless you, now we rent garages to hold all of our stuff. We are a people of bigger barns. Our guy would fit in just fine around here. So, he says, I'm going to build bigger barns. And then he thinks to himself, I'll say to myself, you got plenty of grain laid up for many years. Take life easy, eat, drink, and be merry. Now again, this guy's problem isn't money. Money can be a gift from God, right? His problem isn't that he's got money. And here's the deal. If you are convinced that money itself is inherently evil, please come and see me after church. I will help rid you of that evil, all right? Personal service from me to you, all right? The guy's problem isn't that the money is inherently evil or that he has some, or that, I mean, here's the rich man and more comes in. Rich just keep getting richer. That's not the problem. The problem is he becomes convinced that money is going to do for him what only the one true God will be able to do to him. See, this happens to us. There's something about this particular false god. Money so easily gets us to believe that it will do for us what only the one true God will. Probably more than any other false god out there. And our guy in our story, this is what happens to him. Like he becomes convinced money is going to become the source of his security. If he can just tear down these old barns and build these bigger ones and fill these bigger barns up with all that's come in, then he doesn't have to worry about work. He doesn't have to worry about how to pay the bills. He doesn't worry about the house. He doesn't have to worry about the retirement. Then he'll be secure. Now, do you know anybody like that? Anybody who's chasing hard after money because they're convinced if they can just get enough, they're not going to need to worry about things anymore. If the balance of the bank account, if the IRAs and the 401ks and everything else, if that gets high enough, now we can be calm, now we can be cool because everything's secure. Or do you know somebody who's, they're not even chasing after it anymore. Like, they got there. They've got enough now. And God's nice. It's good to have around. But he's really not necessary when it comes to security anymore. The writer of Proverbs said it this way. He said, give me neither poverty nor riches, but give me only my daily bread. Otherwise, I may have too much and disown you and say, who's the Lord? Do I really need him to be secure anyway? The guy in our story looked to money to provide him with security. He also looked to money to provide him with satisfaction. He's like, you know, if I can just get enough in these barns, if I can just have a little bit more, then it's going to be so good. I can eat, I can drink, I can be merry. Do you know anybody like that? They're dreaming, you know, they'll say things like, if I can just buy this, that'll be so good. If we just made this much per month, man, life would be great. If I could just retire at that age, then it'd be gravy from there. And the funny part is, like, we should know this won't work because we've experienced it on a lesser scale all kinds of times. Like, did you ever see that thing and you dreamt about that thing and you schemed about how you're going to get that thing and you finally bought that thing, whatever it was, and then you got that thing and a week later it was like, eh. Like, I remember, like, end of high school, beginning of college, I've got my dad's stereo system in my bedroom. He wasn't using it, let me use it. I was like, this is awesome, right? And I'm thinking, okay, I need to start, you know, because you got the speakers, you've got the receiver, and you've got the turntable. We were rocking vinyl, baby, right? And I'm like, well, we got to upgrade some of this. So I went out and I bought a dual cassette player. Yeah, all right? And I'm like, well, I got to start switching some of the pieces out. I got to buy some of my own stuff and get his stuff out of here so when I leave, I can take it with me. And I can remember going to the store, and there was this massive pair of Pioneer speakers, right? Big enough a person could climb in there. And I'm thinking, if I can just get those speakers, I can make the windows in the house shake, right? And so I save up, and I'm dreaming, and I'm scheming, and I finally go to ABC Warehouse, closest thing to wholesale, and I buy the speakers, and I bring them home, and I install them, and I crank it up, and my parents are like, turn it down, and I'm like, if it's too loud, you're too old, right? And we have this war, but it's their house, so I turn it down. And about a week later, I'm sitting in my room. The thrill was gone. I thought, what am I going to do? I'm going to save up for a new receiver, right? We've all been there. You dream about this thing, and it's going to just satisfy you, and then you get it, and it fades so fast. Christmas Day, and then a week later, it's like, what? Yeah. I don't know, it's about a week for me, it's about what it takes, you know? I don't know. And again, the research bears this kind of stuff out. Some other research I was looking at, they were talking about money and satisfaction. And they found some things where you're like, well, that's no surprise. And then some other things that kind of mess with your brains a little bit. Like they found that people living beneath the poverty line, that they struggle with satisfaction in life. Like, if you don't have enough to meet your basic needs, you wrestle with that emotionally. But as soon as a person gets above the poverty line, things change drastically. Like, they found that people who are making just $20,000 a year and folks who are making $100,000 a year, there's very little difference in their life satisfaction. Huge salary difference, but very little difference in how much they really are satisfied with life. The researchers concluded this. They said, the belief that high income is associated with good mood is widespread, but mostly an illusion. See, we'll chase after money hard, thinking, this is going to satisfy me. And all the while, it just distracts us from the thing that really will. Third thing our guy does is he looks to money for a source of significance. If I can just have bigger barns, if I can just get my net worth high enough, that's going to determine my self-worth. Then I'm going to be important. Then I'm going to be somebody. And just one last time, do you know anybody like that? Do you know anybody who, on an emotional level, their value is tied to the car they drive, how many square feet their house is, or what zip code it's located in, or the tag on their clothes? Do you know anybody who's spending money they don't have to buy things they don't need to impress people they don't even like? It's easy to look to money to make us feel better about ourselves. Our guy does it. He looks to money for significance and satisfaction, and security. All things that God should be doing for him. And again, money's not his problem. Greed is his problem. He thinks that life is going to be found in the abundance of his possessions. That life, satisfaction, and significance, and security are going to be found in how much stuff he has. And so the God of money just climbs right up onto the throne of his heart, and it gets real comfortable there. And it begins to determine the direction and the outcomes in his life. And so Jesus says of this man, you know, he says, I'm gonna have plenty of grain laid up for many years. I'm going to take life easy, and I'm going to eat, and I'm going to drink, and I'm going to be merry. But God says to him, you fool. This very night, your life will be demanded from you. Then who will get what you've prepared for yourself? I mean, here's this guy who chases money to find security, and now life's thrown him a curveball, and it doesn't matter how much money he has. There's no security found in it. And here's this guy who chases money to find satisfaction. And all of a sudden, everything that he's going to has worked for, somebody else is going to get it. And how satisfying is that going to be? And here's this guy who chased money to feel good about himself, to find significance. My net worth is going to be going to determine my self-worth. But you can't take any of it with you. And so on the other side of the grave, what is any of that going to be worth anyway? In an instant, everything he's worked for is gone. And Jesus ends his story that way. Happy little tale it is. And then Jesus says something that should mess with us. He says, this is how it will be with whoever stores up things for themselves but is not rich towards God. In other words, if greed's an issue for me, if I've got enough to meet my needs and I still want more for me anyway, then I'm a prime candidate to have the false god of money sit on the throne of my heart. And according to Jesus, I shouldn't expect radically different outcomes to the end of my story than the story I just read. That should keep me up at night. So, question then becomes, if you know somebody who's anything like the guy in the story, how do you help them dethrone the god of money? So let's talk about that. There's a few things I'd suggest. First one is this. If I'm going to dethrone the god of money, I need to learn to turn. And what I mean by that is I need to recognize, okay, right now is one of these moments where I'm looking to money to give me security or significance or satisfaction. I'm going to recognize that in my life, and I'm going to intentionally turn to God for these things instead. Now, that can look different for different people. For example, maybe that's going to mean I'm going to turn down some of the overtime. Or I'm not going to work so hard to climb the corporate ladder. Instead, I'm going to spend some of that time that I would have chasing after money somewhere else. Maybe I'm going to spend it on my relationship with God. Maybe I'm going to spend it on my relationship with my family. Because I'm not going to look to money to make me secure. I'm not going to look to money to satisfy me. I'm going to trust, okay, I've got enough. I'm going to look to God to make me secure beyond that. And I'm going to look to relationships for satisfaction. Or maybe that means for the next 3 months, before I buy something, I'm going to ask a simple question. Why am I buying this? And if an honest answer is more about how this makes me feel emotionally, how this is going to satisfy some hunger or make me feel significant than it is about what I need or my family needs, then I'm just not going to buy it. If I'm going to dethrone money, I'm going to learn to recognize, here it is. I'm looking to money to do what only God can do, and I'm going to turn to God instead. If I'm going to dethrone the god of money, I need to recognize that it's all God's stuff. The money, the possessions, the investments, it's all God's. The psalmist puts it this way. He says, the earth is the Lord and all it contains, the world and those who dwell in it. My stuff, your stuff, my money, your money, it's all God's. He's the owner, we're the manager. And lest I think that you know, it's my great talents that have allowed me to accumulate so much of God's stuff, Moses is quick to dissuade me of that notion. He tells me, but remember the Lord your God, for it is he who gives you the ability to produce wealth. Even my ability to amass some stuff comes from God, and it's his stuff. Here's the thing. To the degree that I can see my stuff and my money as God's stuff and God's money, there's peace that goes along with that. Because when we're losing money, if it's not my money, I don't have to worry as much about it. When stuff isn't holding up like you'd like it to, it's not my stuff. It's God's stuff. I don't need to worry as much about that. I mean, now, if I'm being irresponsible with God's stuff, I should worry about it. So I'm just trying to do this well right now. We recently moved into Farmington Hills, bought a home, If you're thinking about buying a home and using the inspector, I have one I recommend you don't use. All right? Because he missed that our roof leaks like Swiss cheese, right? And so I'm like, stuff isn't doing what I want the stuff to be doing. And the money's going in ways I don't want the money to be going. To the degree that I see it as God's money and God's stuff, I am way less stressed out about it. And to the degree that I see it as my money and my stuff, my stress level goes up. And I'm able to measure how much I see this as mine and how much I see it as God's by the level of stress I'm feeling in my life. If I'm going to dethrone this thing, I got to recognize it's God's. And if I'm going to dethrone this thing, I'm going to give generously. Jesus said, he said, watch out, be on your guard against all kinds of greed. Jesus is telling me, hey, look deep inside and see, is there something there that wants more for you anyway, even though you have enough? Watch out for that thing. One of the best antidotes to greed is given. When I freely, no strings attached, give the money away, greed loses a little bit of its grip on me. It's one of the reasons that tithing is so important. When I tithe, I choose to give back to God 10% of my income specifically for building his church. And when I do that, I recognize it's not all mine. It's his. And when I do that, I'm honoring what Jesus taught me about how to live with my money. To do otherwise, if I'm a follower of Jesus, to do otherwise would be for me to try and rob God. And when I'm doing that, I'm saying to money, you don't get to own me. Watch this. I'm going to give you away. It helps root greed out of my life. One more thing, and it's not up on the screen. All right. Here's the thing with money. Getting messed up with money takes time. Usually you turn 18 and somebody thought it'd be a good idea to let you take out a loan and give you a credit card, right? And then for years, we begin to tie these knots in our financial ropes, right? And sometimes, some of us, we've been doing this for decades, right? And then you hear a sermon about money, you're like, man, I got all kinds of knots in my rope. I don't know what to do here. And the issue is, money's not a one-sermon-fixes-all kind of problem. If it took years to tie all these knots in your rope, you're not untying them on a Sunday morning. All right? There are a number of concepts that we probably need to sit down and think through. There's just all kinds of different ideas that factor into the equation. And you probably need practical tools put into your hand, tools designed to help you untie those knots. And you probably need some community to help you with this, because if you could have untied all those knots by yourself, you'd have done it already, right? So, because we don't want to just be a church that talks about the right thing to do, we want to be a church that helps you do the right thing, here's the deal. Mark your calendar. January 12th. January 12th. You're like, that's forever away. You're going to blink and it's going to be here, right? All right. January 12th, we're going to launch a new series, Rethink Money. It's going to be a church-wide series. On Sunday mornings, we're going to talk about some of the concepts that help us rethink how to do money. Because our culture has talked to us about, here's how you do money, and you just look around. It's not working. All right? So we're going to talk about this on Sundays. And then in our growth groups and our small groups, we're going to give folks the practical tools they need to begin to untie some of those knots in their rope. And so if you're in a God's at War group right now, I want to encourage you, before this series ends, talk to the group. Talk about getting the band back together in January and doing that series together as a small group. Or do one better. Don't stop meeting. Keep meeting through the ends of God's at War. Meet through the time between now and January, and then keep meeting together in January. And if you're like, what are we going to meet about in that in-between time? Panic not. Adult discipleship is in just in a week or two. They're going to be coming out with options for you, all right? Take the time that you have between now and January. Invest in those relationships that will pay dividends when you get there in January. So, money. Not a good thing, not a bad thing. Just the thing. What we do with money determines whether or not this becomes a good thing or a bad thing in our lives. And like few other things, money will compete with God for first place. It's just unique. It's why Jesus said, you can't serve both God and money. All the things he could have picked, he picked money. So rather than chase money, let's chase Jesus. Because the security we long for, it's found in the one who will never leave us or forsake us. Let's chase Jesus because the sense of significance that we long for, it's found when our identity is found in him. Let's chase Jesus because the satisfaction that our hearts desire, they're found in the one our hearts were made for. Let's chase Jesus. He can give us what only God can, because he is God come to us in flesh.